Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Kaelin Davenport, lecturer in Roman history at Macquarie University. This is episode LXXXII, Pertinax. Many saw Pertinax as a safe pair of hands to hold the empire. An old general and close advisor of Marcus Aurelius, he represented a regime change from the days of lavish excess of Commodus. But was it too much too soon? Well, they don't call 193 CE the year of the five emperors for nothing. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
193 is a massive year of change for the Roman Empire, because you have the end of the Antonine dynasty with Commodus, which has really ruled since the time of Nerva. And here you have, you know, a succession of emperors, Pertinax, Didius Julianus, and then three other claimants to the throne who are all powerful military commanders, Septimius Severus, Clodius Albinus, Pescinius Niger, and they're all coming from different parts of the empire, Britain, the Danube, and Syria, all trying to lay claim to Rome. So all trying to really fill that power vacuum.
So in that one year, we call it the year of the five emperors, and there were five claimants, but I can't see there being more than three recognized emperors. Is that true?
Yeah, certainly within Rome itself, recognized by the Senate. So you have Pertinax, who's then murdered, and then Didius Julianus buys the empire at auction, which is one of the most fascinating episodes in all of Roman history. And then when he's declared a public enemy by the Senate, Septimius Severus is recognized. Augusti. So, you know, the full emperor has the rank of Augustus.
So with the death of Commodus, Pertinax is now the claimant to be emperor. What does he do to solidify his position then?
Well, it seems very likely through a series of coincidences that Pertinax is in on the plot. He knows that, you know, once Commodus has been strangled by Narcissus, the athlete, that he is going to be the next emperor. So, you know, he has to go and secure the loyalty of the Praetorian Guard, essentially. They're the kingmakers in the city of Rome. So if he's going to be the emperor that succeeds Commodus, he needs their support.
So who was Pertinax then? What do we know about his background?
Well, Pertinax is a particularly fascinating character. He's one of these sort of self-made men. I mean, he's the son of a freedman, so his father was a former slave, but very often these former slaves are able to become quite wealthy, particularly from business interests, and it seems that his father, Helvius Successus, was involved in the wool trade. So he's born in Italy, in the Apennine region, in 126, and if we think back to previous episodes, that's in the reign of Hadrian. So this is a man who's been alive since one of the earlier emperors in the Antonine dynasty. He works his way up. He must have acquired equestrian rank. So in the social hierarchy of the Roman world, the senatorial order sits at the top. You have 600 members of the Senate, all of whom have a fortune of a million sesterces or more. So
is that like the buy-in?
Yeah, I mean, well, you have to own that much property to be considered worthy of being a member of the Senate.
Oh, wow.
But because there's only 600 members, you have to wait for there to be a vacancy, essentially, before you can enter it. So there's lots of people who are multimillionaires who aren't in the Senate. I mean, they may not have wanted to be, but there's certainly a limit. With the equestrian order, on the other hand, there is no limit. So you have to have a minimum property of 400,000 sesterces, which is still very wealthy compared to most people in the Roman world. But many of them are far wealthier. So the fact that Pertinax later on tries to become a military officer, which you have to be of equestrian rank to be, shows that his family was obviously quite wealthy.
Okay.
But he actually began his career as a teacher, as a grammaticus, teaching Latin. And he did that for about 10 years from his mid-20s till his mid-30s.
Wow, so he got into the military quite late, given the day, really?
Very much so. Yeah. I mean, if you're going to be an equestrian military officer, there's sort of different groups. There are those who enter in their late teens, but there are also those who enter in their mid-30s. I mean, for Pertinax, he wanted more money, essentially. There wasn't much money in teaching. not much has changed.
No comment.
There.
Yeah.
But thanks to the intercession of his family's patron, Lollius Avitus, he was able to acquire a military commission. Now, originally he wanted to be a centurion, and that was a better career option if you wanted to spend your entire life in the military, because there weren't any immediate term limits to that. Whereas The office that he ended up as an equestrian officer, these were only short-term commands with no guarantee of future employment. And they're generally only 2 to 3 years. So he needed to depend on continuous patronage to get more and more positions the equestrian military career.
So sometimes these feel like they're retconned, but for somebody who ends up being an emperor, there is generally omens that you can point to back yes. in their career.
Yes.
Real or imagined or exaggerated as they may be. Do we have anything like this coming up in Pertinax's early life or career?
Yes. Apparently, at the hour he was born, a dark horse climbed onto the roof tiles and after staying there for a short time, fell down and expired to signal the fact. I think it must be the death of Commodus, surely, is the dark horse and that, you know, Pertinax is the man who's going to take over from that. But yes, I agree, they are retconned usually later. If you are an emperor, you have to have lots of glorious omens. And Pertinax was no different.
That one just raises more questions than it answers. You know, what is the horse doing on the roof? How did it get onto the roof?
Well, there's actually quite a lot of horse omens with Pertinax. So
I thought you were about to say there's a lot of horses climbing on roofs.
No. Well, I don't know about that. Horses aren't my expertise, so I'd have to do some more research into that. But no, there's an omen that later on that we'll hear about. Septimius Severus dreams that he succeeds Pertinax when Pertinax is thrown off a horse.
Right.
And there's horse in the games, and people cry out that it's Pertinax. So this seems to be his thing. It's his motif.
So we've come across Pertinax a bit in the life of Marcus Aurelius. Mm. He's come up again in Commodus. He seems to be very much considered a reliable military figure for Marcus, somebody who can be sent to take care of things, and the same for Commodus as well.
Definitely. I mean, he's someone who keeps on getting equestrian military commands. And as I said, you need to have patronage in order to do that. And he benefits from the patronage of Claudius Pompeianus, who's one of the greatest generals under Marcus Aurelius's reign, you know, marries Lucilla, his daughter. So he benefits from his patronage. There is a period where Pertinax falls from grace for a while, but then that's probably due to sort of senatorial intrigues. But then Marcus Aurelius actually promotes him from the equestrian order into the Senate and gives him the command of a legion to right the wrongs that were done to him in the past. And this is a big step. To command a legion, you have to be of praetorian rank. So Pertinax is actually elected, that's a formal term, into the Senate as if he was an ex-praetor and then given a legionary command. And after that, he goes on to serve in many important commands. Towards the end of Marcus Aurelius' reign, he's appointed governor of Syria, which is a major province with 3 legions. He really wins a name for himself that way. In 175, he was made consul, the aim of all senators, the chief magistracy in the Roman state. And that caused some eyebrows to be raised amongst other senators. I mean, Cassius Dio talks about some of the resentment which Pertinax engendered. This was the son of a freedman who had now become a general and now a consul. But Marcus wasn't having any of that. You know, Marcus delivered a speech praising Pertinax's quality. So he was definitely someone that Marcus relied on.
Yeah. So through his career, I think we've seen him involved in the Parthian War, heavily involved in the Marcomannic Wars as well. Given how much of an impact that had on the reign of Marcus Aurelius, it sounds like Pertinax was somebody who was maybe one of his close advisors.
Yeah, he was definitely one of Marcus Aurelius' very trusted associates, like Claudius Pompeianus, for example, and Aufidius Victorinus, who is a descendant of Marcus Cornelius Fronto, Marcus Aurelius' tutor. This coterie of illustrious senators, but also former equestrians who are promoted to the Senate, whom Marcus relies on to the very end of his career. And Marcus hopes that these are going to be the men who are going to guide Commodus after he dies and he passes the imperial purple onto his son. Because it's clearly going to be a dynastic succession there when you have a son like Commodus who's born to the purple.
We've established in previous episodes of Emperors of Rome that being a senator under Commodus is never a secure career path. So how does Pertinax fare during that time?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting career under Commodus. I mean, Cassius Dio says that Pertinax is one of 3 senators who were trusted by Marcus Aurelius, whom Commodus doesn't do away with. Now, it's clear that Pertinax was out of favour in the early part of Commodus's reign. So he comes back from his governorship of Syria in 182. It's actually the first time he enters the Senate House then, because he's been off on campaign all this time. But he falls afoul of Commodus's prefect at the time, Perennis, and is sent into exile. But then after Perennis falls from favour, Pertinax is able to come back into favour and is actually sent off to Britain, where he is a successful military commander, really imposes discipline on the troops. He really wins a reputation as a stern disciplinarian, which might be good or bad, depending on your point of view, and then is proconsul of Africa, and then urban prefect. And then he receives the honour of a consulship for the second time in 192 with Commodus himself. So he's clearly someone whose career actually benefits from Commodus's reign. There are different readings of this. One could be that he's the old war horse, serves Rome in whatever capacity it's demanded, regardless of who the emperor is. The life of Pertinax in the Historia Augusta is very interesting because it talks about him, you know, turning informer on other senators and denouncing them to the emperor. So there may be the sense that he's trying to butter Commodus up. I mean, the Senate is divided into factions in any reign. I mean, they're not, you know, parties or anything like that, but certainly there's shifting factions and shifting alliances. And it seems that Pertinax did very well in the last years of Commodus's reign.
It would be a good way to secure your position if you informed on other people who are conspiring against the emperor, especially if you know that you suspect that that plot won't be successful.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we saw similar things in the reign of the Emperor Domitian. I mean, if you believe Tacitus and Pliny, Domitian was completely anti the entire Senate. But we know that's not true because he had senatorial cronies who were informing on other senators. So there's really divisions within the Senate. And if we believe the Historia Augusta, which provides this interesting alternative view, then Pertinax is also someone who's doing that. Why should we believe the Historia Augusta here compared to Cassius Dio, who's a much more positive portrait? Well, one of the Historia Augusta's main sources was Marius Maximus, who is also a senator at this period and wrote biographies of Roman emperors from Nerva to Elagabalus. And he became a very prominent senator under Septimius Severus. So he also knew what was going on. So is this the Historia Augusta taking this other tradition and embellishing it? But does it actually have a kernel of truth that there are senators who didn't really like Pertinax because of his relationship with Commodus?
There's one other thing that we should maybe touch on in all of this, and that's when he was in Britain. Do we know anything about how he was regarded by the troops or how he managed the legions?
Yeah, he was known as a stern disciplinarian, but this sometimes didn't really have the right result for Pertinax himself. The Historia Augusta tells us he did in fact suppress the mutinies against Commodus in Britain, but came into immense danger, being almost killed in a mutiny of the legion. At any rate, he was left among the dead. This affair, of course, Pertinax punished very severely. As a result of this, he sought to be excused from his legateship, saying that legions were hostile to him because of his maintenance of discipline.
Yeah.
And Pertinax's reputation as his stern disciplinarian is really going to come back and bite him when he's emperor and he's having to deal with the Praetorian Guard, because they know about his actions in Britain.
I've heard of more stern commanders in the military. I mean, the whole practice of decimation, for example.
No, we don't get too many details apart from the fact that he's a stern disciplinarian. I suppose particularly the Praetorians in Rome, who Pertinax has to deal with as emperor, are more pampered than the other troops. They're used to getting their way, they have shorter terms of service, they're paid more, so they're not going to brook any form of discipline, or especially something that's contrary to what they're used to under Commodus.
All right, so Commodus dies, and as you said, the first thing that Pertinax feels that he needs to do is to go and get the Praetorian Guard on his side to convince them that he should be the one who should be emperor. One, amazing that it's got to that point that the Praetorian Guard are the kingmakers now. How does he go about that?
He's clearly prepared. You know, on the night of Commodus's murder.
He's happy New Year, by the way.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Yes, exactly. I'm sure the Romans were happy, especially the consuls whom Commodus planned to kill the next day and take their position. But yeah, he goes straight to the Praetorian camp. He needs to win the soldiers over, otherwise his reign won't be secure. And he promises them 12,000 sesterces a head.
How much is that to a Praetorian guard? Is that a lot of money? Is that a year's wage? How much are we talking?
Their year's wage would be 4,000 sesterces.
So this is three times.
That's three times as much. So that's a good deal, but it's not as much as previous emperors had promised. For example, when Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Verus came to the throne after the death of Antoninus Pius in 161, they promised 20,000 sesterces.
Mm.
And that wasn't a controversial accession by any means.
Actually, though, but if I can speak in Pertinax's defense.
Okay.
Antoninus Pius left the economy in quite good shape. And at this point, where Pertinax is coming to the throne, it's been run into the ground by years of war and plague.
That is true, and there are stories about him selling off the artworks of the palace and, you know, the furniture and things like that. You might remember Marcus Aurelius is said to do the same thing to raise money during the Marcomannic Wars. So I agree. I mean, Pertinax should be a good economic manager, and this is what he tries to do. The problem is the Praetorian Guard in Rome need to be assaged. They're the people who can make and break an emperor in the city of Rome itself.
Yep.
And they're used to life under Commodus. Now, there are two stories about what Pertinax actually does. Cassius Dio says he gave them the full 12,000 sesterces. But Historia Augusta says he only gave them half the amount, 6,000. And if that's true, that would be a very bad move. Because
yeah,
there's nothing guaranteed to irritate soldiers more than by paying them half of what they were promised.
So at the moment, he started off the new year by buying them off and becoming emperor.
Mm.
And Rome has to wake up to a horrible hangover in the morning, I suppose. After a hell of a Commodus party for 12 years, they've now got Pertinax sitting there in the Senate House.
Well, yes. So he tries to be the opposite of what Commodus was, to usher in not only the new year, but a new age. So he goes to the Senate House, and there, waiting for him in the early hours of the morning, is Claudius Pompeianus, one of his fellow great generals under Marcus Aurelius, who you'd remember from the Commodus episode, has been off in self-imposed exile in Italy, claiming bad eyesight. And the fact that he turns up here at the Senate on the same night that Commodus is murdered and Pertinax is proclaimed emperor is a pretty good indication that Pertinax knew what was going to happen and was in on the plot. And Pertinax tries to offer the purple to Claudius Pompeianus. Of course, you know, Pompeianus was a son-in-law of Marcus Aurelius, but Pompeianus says no. It's sort of part of the theatre of being a Roman emperor, that if you're a good emperor, you have to perform the act of recusatio or refusal in English. You have to pretend you don't want the job. That's the only way to show that you're really a good emperor.
And it says that Claudius Pompeianus wept at the fate of Commodus. And I suppose I can buy that to some extent because these two men, they both saw Commodus grow up. So
yeah, and it's something that, you know, you don't want to take lightly. I mean, Roman senators, you know, don't go around killing, you know, the sons of the great emperor who they worshipped for so many years lightly. I mean, they all wanted to guide Commodus. You know, when Herodian has this great speech of Pompeianus at the beginning of his history, when he says, you know, we're going to advise you, Commodus, in your reign. But then Commodus rejects all this advice. So, yeah, I think there's a sort of bittersweet nature about this, that yes, Commodus is gone, the reign of terror is over. On the other hand, it's also the end of the Antonine dynasty, this dynasty which has continued since the time of Nerva through this principle of adoption. It's the end of a dynasty, and that's a sad moment for Rome. The Senate gathers, and they couldn't be happier that Commodus is gone. They break out into these ritual chants. Now, lots of chants and acclamations happen in Rome on a regular basis, in the Senate House, in the games, etc. Very often, it's in praise of the emperor. But here, it's in celebration of the death of Commodus and all the horrible things they want to do to him. So they shout out, let him be dragged by the hook. So let his body be dragged around like a common criminal. When bad emperors in inverted commas, died, there had to be a ritual to sort of show that the Roman Empire is moving on. And this is the so-called damnatio memoriae, condemnation divination of memory. The idea that they're going to go out and knock down Commodus' statues, erase his name from inscriptions, and it acts as a sort of catharsis. He's gone, and the fact that, you know, they've scratched his name out shows that he used to be there, but they've triumphed over him. But they also want to do horrible things to Commodus' body. Feelings certainly ran high amongst the senatorial order there.
And as far as Pertinax being emperor, was the Senate okay with that?
Yes, as far as we know, he was acclaimed. He was an able general, an able administrator. Even if we believe the historian Augusta that he was a crony of Commodus, perhaps, or at least had benefited from his regime, he showed that he wanted to be a different style of emperor to Commodus. So he takes the title of Princeps Senatus, the old republican title that was given to the chief man in the Senate, which was to be an ideological statement about the nature of his regime, that, you know, he was going to put the Senate and its concerns first. He wasn't going to be a loutish youth who liked to dress up and, you know, kill animals in the amphitheatre for fun. He was going to be a different type of emperor. And he even refused to make his wife Augusta and refused to make his son Caesar, because he didn't want his son to grow up in the palace like Commodus and grow up to be that sort of man. So he's really trying to put the idea of dynasty away and position himself as, you know, the best man amongst the senators.
The other part of me, though, sees that action of not making his wife Augusta and making his son Caesar as a sign that things might be volatile in the empire at the moment, and he needs to wait for things to settle down at least.
Yeah, I would agree he needs to be cautious, because to start elevating your family members, giving them high titles, could be a sign of hubris. There's a ready-made dynasty here, you know, let's forget about the Antonines. But I think he is trying to also make a clear break there. In the Roman Empire, there's this tension between two competing ideologies. The ideology of dynasty, that, you know, we're going to have sound and stable succession by the son of the previous emperor coming to the throne. But there's also this ideology which sort of developed in the first century AD, that we also want government of the best man. So this is, we see very much in the year of the four emperors, with Galba, for instance, and his choice of Piso as an adopted heir. So there's always this tension between these two elements, and Pertinax is going towards, well, I'm the best man, I'm not going to create a new dynasty suddenly. But I think you're right, it's a good political move to show that he's not too proud and cocky.
So what do we know then about his reign as emperor? He's not emperor for all that long, considering there's five emperors to get through in 193 CE.
Yep.
What does he start by doing in the empire?
Well, the first thing is he starts by looking at the economy. So, as you pointed out, you know, we've had war, we've had plague, we've had all of Commodus's spending. So he has a great garage sale from the palace and sells off some of the artworks and furniture in order to raise money.
So this is all of Commodus's grand spending then?
Yep.
So like gold statues and impressive artworks and carpets and
yes,
stuffed exactly. And mounted ostriches and
yes,
everything.
Yes, exactly. Like, there's a great fire sale. But it also shows that, you know, he's going to be a more austere princeps, an austere emperor compared to Commodus. I mean, the stories about his dining habits, you know, they could either be read as, you know, miserly, or as Cassius Dio says, frugal. You know, he's putting the empire first. And he certainly raises the level of the silver content in the denarius, that's the Roman silver coin, to a level which hasn't been seen since the reign of Vespasian. So he is trying to put the economy on a good footing. The other thing he tries to do is part of his winning over the Senate and sort of putting an end to the injustices of Commodus's reign is that he actually rehabilitates the memory of those senators who had been murdered unjustly and put to death by Commodus. And we know about this from the literary sources, but we also know about this from an inscription on a tomb of one of these senators. It's always great when we have material culture evidence which corroborates our literary sources. So this is the tomb of a senator called Marcus Antonius Antius Lupus. And the inscription says, whose memory was suppressed through violence and was restored in full following a decree of the most distinguished order. And that most distinguished order is the senatorial order. So the Senate passes a decree on Pertinax's authorization to rehabilitate the memory of these people that were unjustly killed by Commodus. So this is a way of signalling that, you know, these injustices were done and now we're drawing a line under that. People can move on.
Yeah. Oh, what a great find. Where's that? Is that outside Rome, is it?
Yes. I don't think it survives anymore, but yeah. We know about it because of a drawing in a Renaissance manuscript.
Nice.
And it's a great image because it has the fasces of office by the side there as well. I think it has a Sella Curulus as well, the curule chair.
Yeah.
So it's a wonderful illustration that, you know, he was reburied and, you know, this tomb was erected to celebrate the fact that the Senate was once again at the forefront of the imperial government under Pertinax.
Yeah, yeah. And his name was Lupus.
Yes, yes, the wolf. Marcus Antonius Antius Lupus. Great name.
Yeah. Okay, so what else? He gets the military's nose out of joint pretty quickly. They try and get rid of him. 3rd of January.
Yes, yeah, there's a couple of plots. So they try and proclaim Triarius Maternus as emperor, but he flees and come and tells Pertinax everything. There's another plot later on when the consul for the year, Sosius Falco, is also proclaimed emperor as well. We're not quite sure whether this is something that Sosius Falco really wanted or if Aemilius Laetus, Praetorian prefect, is behind this. Now, Aemilius Laetus is a very wily character. So you may remember that he was Praetorian prefect in the last years of Commodus, and was behind the plot to kill Commodus with Pertinax. So he's a man that really got the Praetorian Guard on side to support Pertinax. So he's, in a way, he's got that kingmaker role there. But he starts to fall out with Pertinax over the course of his reign. So it's possible that Sosius Falco was declared emperor by the troops at the urging of Aemilius Laetus.
Mm.
And Pertinax pardoned Sosius Falco because he didn't think that he was really behind it. So Pertinax shows mercy there.
That's a good sign, at least.
Commodus would have just hacked his head off. he would have had someone do it like Cleander, the Pugioni, the bearer of the dagger or something like that.
And his family and everyone, yeah.
Seize their property as well. Mm. So Pertinax is really showing he's someone that's very different. But then it all becomes too much for the soldiers. The memory of Pertinax as a stern disciplinarian in Britain has made them apprehensive towards him from the beginning. Then he doesn't promise as much money as they would have hoped, and possibly even only given half as much.
Mm.
And there's this fallout between Pertinax and the Praetorian prefect, Aemilius Laetus. So 300 Praetorian soldiers rush up to the palace on the Palatine Hill. Pertinax meets them there, and like the good statesman he is, he tries to talk to them. And at first it works. The soldiers hang back, apart from one. One leaps forward and exclaims, "The soldiers have sent you this sword," and attacked Pertinax. The Historia Augusta gives us the name of this person, Talzius. So in the end of the day, it's one man who takes it upon himself to kill Pertinax.
It only takes one, though.
It does only take one. It does only take one. And the soldiers, Dio tells us, cut the head off Pertinax and fastened it on a spear, glorying in this deed. So here we have this aged emperor who tried to restore Rome to its former glory after Commodus, who tried to put the Senate first, who tried to curb the ambitions of the soldiers, actually being brought down by the soldiers.
So what date was this?
So this is the 28th of March. He comes to power on the 1st of January, 193, and by the 28th of March, he's murdered.
Okay, so 3 months. So that's not a long time for Rome to get over their Commodus hangover. It's not a lot of time at all for Rome to get comfortable with the new situation, is it?
Not at all. I mean, you still have no clear succession after this. I mean, who now is going to be emperor? You're going to have to look to other leading generals who have also served Marcus Aurelius and Commodus. So you're going to look for someone who's going to be like Pertinax, who has that experience.
So how is Pertinax remembered then?
There's two different views. I mean, as I mentioned, the Historia Augusta does not have a positive view. He's said to have been too parsimonious. Stinginess becomes a vice. You know, you want to hoard everything to yourself. On the other hand is the view of Cassius Dio. And Cassius Dio himself is not unbiased. I mean, he was designated praetor by Pertinax. He's someone who's following a senatorial career at the time, and clearly very much admires Pertinax. And he gives Pertinax a list of virtues which is almost unparalleled in Cassius Dio's Roman history. I mean, in many ways, Pertinax is the ideal emperor. He's stately, he's mild, he's prudent, he's just, he's frugal, and he's great-minded. He says that he shows humaneness and integrity in his imperial administrations. He praises him for his economic management as well, and his concern for the public welfare. But he does have one criticism, and this is that Pertinax, and I quote, failed to comprehend, though a man of wide practical experience, that one cannot with safety reform everything at once, and that the restoration of a state, in particular, requires both time and wisdom. So that he tried to do too much, too quickly. And what did he try to do too quickly? I mean, Dyer praises his relationship with the Senate, he praises his economic administration. To my mind, I think what he tried to do quickly is he tried to curb the ambitions of the soldiers. You know, this was the system that had evolved in the Roman world. Imperial power was guaranteed by the soldiers, and Pertinax couldn't escape his dependence on the army.
That's Dr. Kaelin Davenport, lecturer in Roman history at Macquarie University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts or your other friendly neighbourhood podcasting service. Please leave a review. Reviews are appreciated. You can like Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, the Empire goes to the highest bidder. Until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.